Welcome to episode 91 of Free Radical Radio. This is your mainstay, DJ Rydra.
And your sometimes stay, Squee.
Yeah, I guess I'm the only one that gets a DJ because I'm the I was the only one there when we used to actually be DJs. There's a time where we used to do live radio with on average 12 active listeners at our high peak level, I think, when we did Berkeley Liberation Radio back in West Oakland.
Well, that's a lot of jockeying.
Yeah. It was mostly trying to see how much Pat the Bunny and Bright Eyes I could fit into one episode of Free Radical Radio.
Well, we should include some.
Yeah, we definitely will. So, in case you didn't hear, we have some presentations we've put up. By some, I mean one. We put up a pretty awesome anarchist spirituality Anarchist Spirituality from the East Bay Book and Conversation event, also known as the Book Fair.
And I think it was something like the Crisis of Anarchist something or other.
Yeah, maybe we'll get to that a little bit today. But, Squee, are you going to put your presentation online?
You know, I'm debating it. And part of the debate is that the whole premise of the presentation didn't record. And I've been a little bit shy about re-recording it.
I think that's definitely my fault. I was meandering a little bit and kind of wandering around, and I didn't quite get to the beginning of your presentation, and then I actually didn't listen. I wasn't there for your presentation either, but someone had to table for the radio show. So
yeah, I mean, you know, what I did was definitely meant for a presentation and not for a podcast, but...
Sure.
You get all my views anyway on here.
Yeah, so theoretically we'll put up a couple more. We have one on mass shootings that we've fixed the sound for and edited and just need to get the okay on. And then we also have one on... transhumanism, kind of negating transhumanism.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so we'll see if we can get those up. And I heard from someone in a different podcast that they were theoretically going to coordinate with us about presentations. However, when I asked this human being, a figure at Anarchy, if they wanted to coordinate before the book fair, they shrugged their shoulders. So we both ended up double recording a bunch of things.
Ah, is that... Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
It was a big man of anarchy, you know.
Big man, big recorder.
Yeah. Yes, you know, that's what they say. All right. all right, so in case you're wondering, we still have some t-shirts left. If you haven't checked them out, you should check them out online. Friend of the show, TV, actually, who did the kind of infamous Free Radical Radio on... which was a two-hour takedown of Two Our Friends by the Invisible Committee.
Right.
They do most of our design work for the show, which I think is super awesome. They're a really good artist.
Yeah, probably one of my favorites. If you're familiar at all with Pussmort, who did, like, the Misfits logo and a bunch of other awesome, like, underground metal and punk artwork. Sort of similar, but with a little bit of surrealist twist. I don't know how to put it, but
yeah,
they're good.
Yeah, you should check it out. And I've been mailing them out, so, you know... If you want me to be back in the minds of mailing, feel free to send us an email. Actually, one of the funniest things about my job the last 2 weeks was I'm a nanny now, right? So somehow I mailed out 500 different Christmas cards. My boss knows 500 different people to send Christmas cards to.
That's a lot of employees.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Is maybe she just has a ton of employees.
How's your insurance benefits?
I was just sitting at this table. And it's pretty funny. You know, I've talked about this before. My job is basically like I'm at a feudal manor, right? I'm like at a very nice house in a very extremely rich part of San Francisco. And, you know, I get to work early sometimes. So I'll get to work at like 7 a.m. And I've noticed this thing happens where I avoid bridge traffic by leaving my house at 5 in the morning. And there's no traffic. So I get to the city at like 5:20 or 5:30. And I don't start work till 7. But like if I want to leave at 6:30 or something, I would get there too late because the traffic's really bad.
Right.
So I get there early and I sleep in my car. I think this is something I've done before and I know other people do this. So I park at the Safeway in the Castro of San Francisco and there's a bunch of us other like working folk type people. It's like I have these like rare moments of working in class, which I don't even think is a thing, solidarity, where I'm sitting there and there's like, you know, 15, 20 cars. We're all parked in the back of the Safeway parking lot. We're all sleeping in our cars trying to get like a 1 hour nap before we go to work. And then we all go into the Safeway and get coffee together because there's like a little Starbucks inside there. And it's really quite strange. There's also like a really, there's a pretty strong gay cruising scene at that Safeway at 5:30 in the morning on weekdays.
You know, those are some of my favorite moments in life, though, are these
happenstance. Gay cruising at Starbucks?
Well, I haven't had a lot of success with that, but
yeah.
The
comes with time.
The happenstance across, you know, the unification of the trade workers. Not really, but just these odd situations that happen when people are living the same way and would never meet each other otherwise.
Right. And I noticed these moments happen, too, when I used to live by the beach in San Francisco, when it was, like, freezing cold, foggy morning, just kind of brutal, terrible weather, and everyone's up at 6 just standing in front of their houses in my little part of the neighborhood because there's no jobs there, really. So everyone's getting ready to take the bus to work or the Muni, the train in San Francisco. And everyone's just smoking cigarettes. Like, you can see everyone's air breathing, air in the cold, air, you know, the hot air coming out of the cold, hot mouth air coming out of the cold. It's kind of, like, beautiful in the tragedy of it all, you know?
Well, you know, I always find that these kind of things are preceded by a little bit of that uncanny valley feeling. And then once that ice is broken, you got a whole crew of people that you're just totally tight with. And you have a good time. And you find, like, some shenanigans to get into before work or whatever.
Oh, yeah, we're just sleeping. We have no shenanigans.
No donut hole, donut hole de-holing her.
No, I wish. But people do try to, like, talk me up there. Like, dudes are trying to talk me up. I'm like, dude, I'm, like, not interested right now. It's 5:30 in the morning. I'm going to work. Like, I'm just so not into a conversation right this second.
No blast of the morning vodka.
No, that's definitely happening for some people, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I show up to, like, the feudal manor, right? And I get there and, you know, whatever. I see the kids for, like, 15 minutes and they tell me what they want for snack because they're, you know, whatever. I do their little snack for them. Their mom takes them to work. And then slowly the rest of the feudal servants start rolling in. And, you know, I'm there with a team of construction workers, basically. So it's me, the nanny. There's construction workers. There's people doing the backyard. And then there's, like, a cleaning lady and some other servants. So sometimes it's really bustling with slaves. And and it's funny because usually I have the best job, right? Like, of the slaves, it seems like I have the best job. Maybe the people who run the construction company or the highest in have the best job because they don't do that much manual labor. But it seems like I have the best job of the slaves.
You're,
like,
inside the house.
Yeah, I'm, like, top slave. You know, I'm in there. And anyways, so they've all been making fun of me the last 2 weeks because it's very obvious that my job has been the worst job for the past 2 weeks because I'm sitting in this downstairs room, like, basically setting out these cards like they're wedding envelopes. So I'm, you know, I'm putting inserts into the envelopes like it's a wedding invitation, super fancy, and then I'm putting in the stock card of the kids, and I'm doing this whole thing, and it's just taking me forever to do this. And then they see me wrapping presents. These, you know, I must have wrapped, like, well over 100 presents this week, maybe more. And the funniest part is I thought I did such a shit job because I'm terrible at this. Like, if you know me, you know I'm, like, I'm not – maybe it's because I'm so much –
You're a little rough around the edges.
I'm a little rough around the edges. So maybe it's that I like to phrase it this way. I'm so much of a perfectionist that I can't even do a good job because it's not going to be perfect. So I'm just doing a shit job at everything I do, which is the positivist way to look at this. The pessimistic way to be, I just suck at these things. I think there's probably mostly truth in that one. But anyway, so, you know, I'm trying to do, like, a drum, like a giant jump drum. How do you even wrap that? I'm, like, stuffing the wrapping paper in, like, taping it.
There's, like, a side tape and a twist at the top or some kind of thing.
So it's a whole disaster, basically. And I was so nervous that I was gonna get fired or something because I did such a shit job with all these presents. And she sent me a text that said, like, thanks, exclamation, 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 you rock. And, like, it's really weird to get texts from your boss telling you you rock. And I'm like, does that mean you're going to give me more money? Like, does that mean I'm not getting fired? Like, what does that mean? How do I respond? And I ended up just saying welcome, exclamation mark. Like,
oh,
I thought,
you gotta pile on the butter. That's when you got to be like, oh, I think you're great, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, I thought about saying, like, my pleasure, but it definitely wasn't my pleasure. Like, and I don't want her to think, like, I'm doing this as a pleasurable activity, you know?
No, you don't.
I don't want to set up that false expectation. So I don't know what to do. And I thought a long time before sending that text message.
Yeah. Well, so I got a bunch of work things going on, too.
Oh, yeah. What's going on?
Well, you know, I'm kind of running out of work.
That sounds like you don't have work things going on.
Right. I don't have work things going on. So, you know, I'm in a little bit of a bind and, you know, my profession is somewhere between really, really easy to find a job. But I happen to be a person that is not quite there yet. I'm like a few years shy of actually being able to get most of the jobs in my profession. So
I'm a strong believer in lying. This is what I tell everyone. Like, if you want a job, especially in the Bay where it's so competitive, you have to lie your brains out. Like, you have to become another human being. Forget who you are. Forget everything about yourself. Forget what you've done. Find some people to lie on your resume. Find some people to pretend you did something. And you just start from scratch and you build up a story. You tell a beautiful story. And then you come into that job with a tailored story for it. That's all complete lies.
Yeah, you know, I definitely go the opposite direction. I go the avoid as much commentary about your life as possible and just absolutely schmooze at a superficial level. Buy the coffee. Do whatever you need to do.
I think that's the funniest part about jobs, when you're sitting there in the interview and you're trying to tell someone how much you want this job that you already know you fucking hate more than anything you've ever done. And you know at some point once it's over, you're going to hate it, or once it's, you know, once it gets started. And you're sitting in there and you're like, yeah, man, I'm really passionate about, like, you know, selling paper. I just love paper. I think paper should be really prevalent. And I love the feeling people get when they send cards to each other. And I can't wait to sell that paper to people.
Yeah, I had a place ask me about what I think of the corporate culture that they have there. And it was like, they don't advertise what that culture is. So I'm supposed to, like, guess between the two margins of not knowing at all and assumptions based on, like, a fucking website.
So this breaks down to my biggest problem I have with anarchists in general, and I'm throwing myself in there for sure. So besides my, you know, problems with morality, like eschatological thinking, leftism, like human interventionism, just general fucking moronism, like all the problems inherent in anarchy, the one that's biggest is that there's not enough fucking anarchist criminals. Like, the fact that anarchists don't adopt criminal ways of life, and that so many people I know work such fucking stupid jobs, like fucking nannying, Pete's, like whatever dumbass job people do, you know, it doesn't free us up enough time. You know, we all, you know, a lot of people I know take breaks, like work and save money and take breaks. But, I mean, being shit criminals and, like, basically at best doing some petty theft, I think it's a pretty huge problem.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, I don't know if there is a lack of it, because I don't know. I mean, there might be those anarchists out there that.
Yeah, sure.
Like, there's an information problem when it comes to that, right? If you are doing a criminal thing,
right,
for your life, you're probably not going to be writing on anarchist news or something about what it means to consider Nietzsche. In an anarchist context.
Wouldn't that be way more important, though, if people were somehow able to share this and share ideas about this? Because even, like, I saw something going around like, Christmas or Thanksgiving time on the internet. It was, like, 7 ways you can steal or something. And all it was about, like, food and clothing. It wasn't talking about, like, ways to make actual money, you know?
Oh, well, no one gives a shit about money. That's for sure.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's the thing you want if you want to be free, right? Like, I mean, there's a little bit of the argument we got in last time, but it is fairly relevant.
This,
you know,
is absolutely the argument we got in last time.
All right. So let's move on past that. We're not going to give you any advice on how to be a good criminal. You're going to have to do that yourself. Okay. So today we're going to talk about a few things. We're going to bust out a new topic segment, because we haven't really been doing that lately, mostly because Bellamy was the one really doing that, which was a good thing. I just didn't keep up on it. You know, like, alienation states. We have a bunch of them.
Wingnut Confessional.
Yeah, the only one we keep up with, because that's the one I'm really fond of. We have Fuck You Shima. We haven't done that in a while. I'm sure it still sucks over there. I don't think things are going well. Have you checked?
No.
Okay. So I think it's safe to say that for your reporting of the week, for anyone that complains we don't do enough struggles, Fukushima is bad. Nuclear power is bad. Don't use it.
Right.
Don't build a nuclear power plant, please.
Please.
Please. Okay, so we're going to do a thing called Other People's Projects, and that's going to be called OPP.
Yep.
OPP.
You know me.
You know Squee. It's a new segment. And we're also going to discuss population. And that might sound a little bit abstract, but could anything be less abstract? That's the question we'll ask us, is what does population have to do with our lives? What does it have to do with, as people like to say, an anarchist praxis? And we'll go from there. But first, let's start with other people's projects. Yeah, what's up?
So here we go. We're going to talk about our OPP project for the day.
Yeah. And project is none other than Anarchist News, which you can find at anarchistnews.org. It's relevant to us because we get a lot of feedback on there, I guess, and it probably is that and our Facebook are probably the two places most people tend to come across the project, I would say, besides the word of mouth or something like that.
Right, yeah. Well, you know what I forgot to do? I was going to do this during the introduction.
What's that?
I was going to do the big reveal about what the website for my blog is.
Oh, yeah. So tell people how to find your blog.
All right. So you go to Squee.
Yeah.
And then you put the dot in there.
Uh-huh.
And then Anarchy Planet.
Okay. You know what's also going to be easy is we'll just link this in the episode. So if you want to see Squee's personal life, that's the best way to do it.
There's nothing personal on there. I kind of combed it for all that.
Well, it's kind of underneath. You can see through the veil of politics lies the personal.
The despair.
Yeah, you see the deep darkness once you start reading about it. But anyways, that's a fact, right? That's the real. That's the truth.
Right. So that's another place for feedback. And then we could now we could go on and talk about Anarchist News as a project.
So let's talk about it in one sentence first. Is it good or bad, Squee?
It is good.
And I say it's bad.
Ooh.
That was the whole conversation right there.
Right.
Okay, so let's move on. So, just kidding. So I guess the best way to talk about it is in two ways. One is what gets posted, and the second is what is the commenting like? Because the website really only has two features. Well, three, if you count the forums, which we're going to discuss, it has postings of, I'm putting scare quotes around this, news, and, quote, comments.
Right.
And it's, you can post anonymously. Not all forums can you post anonymously, but on ANews, you can post anonymously, and you can actually pretty easily pretend to be someone else.
And that's an internet-wide phenomena that a lot of news websites are just not allowing comments at all, let alone anonymous ones.
Yeah, like a lot of them, you actually have to log in. Like if you want to comment on, this is embarrassing, but I go on ESPN.com pretty often, sports website. I don't talk about this very often. You have to comment on your Facebook. A lot of them make you use your Facebook to comment.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if they have a deal with Facebook. I wouldn't be surprised if they do. But I guess it's a way they, quote, verify your identity.
Yeah, there's more to that than I care to talk about.
Sure. Okay, so anyways, I mean, how did ANews even really start, Squee?
I have no idea how it started, but I have been on there for like 8 or 10 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a long time.
And you post as yourself.
I do. I post as myself. I always have.
Why do you do that instead of posting anonymously?
Well, one of the things that if you have an account on there, you could edit your comments.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that might be the only reason. But I don't know. I like to take credit for the bullshit I say, and, you know, I've had a few hijinks where I've created some kind of alternate personality and done a thing, but...
Yeah.
No, I like to take credit for what I say, and, you know, if you, like, search the page, you know, I search my name, I get to see if anyone responded, that kind of thing.
I see. So it's a purely narcissistic project for you.
Oh, yeah, that was one of our big ones, right? We're narcissists.
Yeah, yeah. We're narcissists. So, I don't know. Sometimes I find value in the comment section, but a lot of times I don't. I don't think it's one of the best places for discourse online. I think it's one of the only places. I went to Reddit Anarchy maybe a week and a half ago.
Jesus.
What a fucking nightmare that was. And this only confirms my suspicion. You know how I was saying the other day that I think I'm just going to throw it out there. 85% of people that call themselves anarchists, I consider socialists. I consider anarchist communists at best and socialist Democrats at worst. And if you go to Reddit Anarchy, that is confirmed there.
Unless you start looking at the anarcho-capitalist bullshit that's on there.
Yeah, sure. That's the other 14%. Then you have 1% of reasonable people.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that whole conversation... Yeah, I'm not going to re-argue that whole point.
Okay.
But...
Well, I'm just telling you I'm right. That was the whole point of the conversation.
Yeah, you were wrong.
Okay, so what is the reputation? What do you consider the reputation of ANews? Because when people go to a site, they obviously have a certain expectation. Like when I go to Stab Mag, which is probably the best surfing website there is, which with the best surfing videos, I expect just a brutal shit show of bro commenting. So is there a different expectation for ANews?
So the way that I think about it, I'm going to, you know, it changes a bit over time, but during the Occupy period, right, Anarchist News used to do, like, sort of a minute-by-minute following of whatever big thing was happening. And for Occupy, that resulted in everybody that wanted to talk shit to an anarchist went to Anarchist News to talk shit. And it was a very lively, you know, living kind of organism. now, I mean, not to blame the website, but there isn't fuck all going on.
Yeah, and it seems like the conversations that do happen are usually centered around a troll. Like, it seems like the most lively conversations, for the most part, happen when, like, certain well-known commentators who people think are white supremacists or whatever come and say some anti-identitarian stuff or say some bioregionalist stuff, and it kind of jumps from there with people with a crusade to purge the internet of these people.
Right, and, you know, I remember, you know, kind of being like this before, and during those interim periods, it was like, oh, the website is going to now go off in a... try a bunch of different things, like they started a chat room, probably like 7 years ago now.
I think a chat room would be kind of cool.
They had one, and they, at one point, they had like something called nice.anarchistnews.org, which was like a totally cleaned up, like not no trolls allowed version of the website.
Yeah.
They have failed to get the forums to do anything forever.
I think forums are just a general failure. I don't know if – I haven't been on there in, like, a year, but I – you know, Kevin Tucker tried to do the black and green forums, and it just didn't work. No, hardly anyone was posting. It was totally dead. I just don't know if forums are a thing anymore. Are they still a thing? I guess – I think it seems like most people just go on Reddit, right? Like, if they want to do a forum-style thing.
You know, that might be a good point. They probably go to Reddit. I don't go to any forum.
Yeah, really. Me neither. I can't think of any forums I go to online.
No. Yeah, the last one I probably really did was the RAN, Red Anarchist, anti, whatever the fuck it was, Red and Anarchist Action Network.
Right. And then, so I guess, I mean, what do you think about the comments section? Because you're an active participant in it, so do you find value in there? Like, do you find yourself challenged? Do you find your ideas changing through your conversations on there?
Well, no, not anymore. I used to. I used to actually have a really, like, enlightening experience in the comments section. Where I would, there would be a few people that would give some like pretty fucking legitimate feedback that ripped into the ideas that I was presenting and things like that. I don't know if I've developed better arguments or just that people don't care anymore. But now the feedback is kind of like, I'm going to get trolled for 10 comments and then someone will be like, yeah, okay. You actually are human, and you do care.
That's the funniest part, is anytime I've gotten trolled on there and, like, responded, which is not very often because, I don't know, it just feels kind of weird to respond on there as, like, you know, as whatever I am on the radio, but which is just me, I guess, so it's not that weird. But, you know, the few times I have done that, people are like, oh, yeah, you're a human being. Oh, I'm sorry for saying that terrible thing or whatever. And it's kind of this total break into the real for them, I think. It's kind of a bizarre moment.
Why? You know, my biggest problem with the internet is I'm never sure if I am actually being trolled, because the most common thing that tends to happen for me, it's like, to me, it seems like a great technique to troll someone, like intentionally misread what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And then, like, write a response to your misreading. So, like, an example would be, like, I'm going to write 10 paragraphs on humanism, and someone's response will, like, it won't even include any of the terminology of what I wrote about. It'll be like, oh, so you just think humans are bad and they should all die.
Yeah.
And it's like,
just garbage.
Yeah. Or, you know, maybe if it's a little bit more, like, finessed, it might like include half a paragraph of what I said and like try to like analyze that. So I always try to give people the benefit of the doubt, and one of two things happen. Either no one responds to that, or they keep going, and I'm never sure throughout the whole conversation whether or not they actually want clarification.
Yeah.
Or if they're actually just fucking with me.
Yeah, which is why I think the email for the show is pretty nice, because when people email us, it seems fairly genuine for the most part. We actually almost never get people upset with us, which I think is kind of funny. Someone messaged a while back who was upset. Oh, what was that person upset about? Do you remember?
Wild reaction.
That's true. That's the thing that seems to bother most people. I'm actually thinking about bringing my thoughts on Wild Reaction to, like, a coherent essay or something, so I can just kind of put it out there and be done.
Well, you could post it to Anarchist News.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I guess I could. I don't want to do that.
I've done a few. I've posted a few things I wrote on there.
Yeah, sure, but you're more engaged there than I am. But anyways, as soon as I wrote them, I wrote this person back. You know, some person in Arizona, and I wrote them back, and, you know, I said, you know, I basically said what I thought about it. And they were like, oh, so you actually, like, have a thinking brain, and you're interested in these things, and blah, blah. And, you know, it was funny because the first thing I said was, I just wanted to fucking write you this email and just hate you and be done with it. But now it's frustrating because you actually engaged me in conversation. I was like, well, you know, that's like really the whole point of doing the radio show is to actually engage people in conversation. Because when Bellamy and I first started doing the show, we were really sick of the way people talk to each other and the shallowness of discourse. And all we not wanted was a better discourse. We want to have better conversations because we believe that possibly the discourse leads to some type of interesting action. And at least for us, it does. At least the discourse we were involved in our life led to the actions we took as we considered ourselves anarchists or as we moved away from past identities that we didn't hold any longer.
Yeah, that's a very rare thing on Anarchist News. Like, what, you got Emil, who has the same spiel over and over again, and somehow they think, like, creating a jargon is going to clarify what they're talking about. It's you know.
Yeah. So let's talk about discourse as a whole really quick.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because discourse is something I've been thinking about more lately, especially reading Delaney, and I'm not going to get too into it, but, you know, he wrote a whole long essay on discourse and what it means to be, like, engaged in a conversation with other people, more or less, and how important the way you have that conversation is and how that conversation is framed affects the ideas within the conversation. And I more or less want to get into what anarchist discourse looks like right now, and can it be improved, and does it matter? Does it even matter?
Let's talk about what it used to look like.
Okay.
Or at least the records that we have of it.
Okay.
It used to look
like... How far back are you going to go?
All the way.
Okay.
I mean, it used to be like one organization communicating with another, and then you have a few personal letters here and there when, like, people actually get to meet each other, but... because of just the technology itself, you kind of had to filter everything through an official voice in a way.
Yeah, and then you also had like a more salon style where people would meet up in person. Like, I'm thinking like maybe 70 to 100 years ago where people would meet up in person. I guess part of it is the organization thing, but as it went, I'm thinking more...
Off the record. Yeah. That's all off the
record. I'm thinking about off the record stuff now.
Okay. Well, I don't think that's different. I think that is... The same as it has been.
Okay.
I think on the record is different.
Okay, I guess that's true. I guess... I don't know. I don't know how much... It's not the same, though. I don't feel like people do it in the same way. At least they haven't in places I've been. Like, I haven't seen a lot of people going to the back alleys of bars and really having, like, long, real conversations. Maybe once in a while. I guess it happens in houses and things like that. But I guess maybe I romanticize, like, Italy and places like that and thinking about, like, you know, Renzo and some other people sitting in a bar really hashing it out, you know? It might just be a totally romantic idea I have of a better discourse.
No, I just think that's regional. I definitely am hashing things out at a bar in the back alley.
Okay.
But, no, I mean, the official on-the-record discourse is totally different because it's not organizations communicating with each other. And this is something that's, like, different even within the past 20 years.
Yeah.
Is used to have your little anarchist collective or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, for Phoenix Anarchist Coalition. And you would release a statement from the entirety of the collective. Whereas now, I mean, not to get back into the debate about the anarcho-communists.
Yes.
But they are not organizing in that way. Like, you're not getting a lot of official, like, this is what we think about wild reaction. This is what we think about.
And when you get it, it's mostly laughed off as patently absurd.
Right.
It's not seriously engaged with for the most part.
Or as a extremely minority view.
Right.
I mean, it used to be very representational that you would get these kind of statements.
But the way you're talking about anarchist discourse is almost sounds like a party system with many different anarchist parties communicating with each other.
Well, it was.
Oh, that's kind of gross.
I mean,
I don't know if I'm a fan of that.
No one got, like, elected or anything like that, but...
But I guess even when you think about what most of us here in America, at least most people I know, their familiarity with anarchy is, you know, that the kind of, like, I think what people consider the golden age of anarchy in America, maybe, for lack of a better term, you know, Voltaire and Duclair, Emma Goldman, Johan Moist, Alexander Berkman, like that period from the end of the 1800s till the smash up of it with the, you know, the deportations and stuff that happened in the early 1900s.
Right.
And I think, you know, what do people think of back then? They think of soapboxing, right? Like actually standing up, giving speeches, right? A lot of these anarchists were on speaking tours all the time, but they didn't really look like what they look like now. But I guess that was more of a thing that was happening in general. Like, because I don't think these speaking tours were just anarchists. Like, they would speak at, like, women's events or things
or
like that.
Or labor events.
Or, yeah, women's events, labor's events, whatever it was, right?
Right.
And I guess anarchy at that point, obviously, was super tied into the labor movement, much more so than it is now because, I mean, I would argue that the labor movement is a totally different thing now, obviously, because labor is so different now, but...
Yeah, well, there's like three things that I would want to comment
right,
on what we just said.
I don't want to go down that tangent, but
the main difference is that the discourse now is not only a bunch of anonymous fucking comments
right.
about whatever that totally mediate everything else, as far as I'm concerned. But the technology is just so different that, you know, like, all right, how do I put this? Even today, Wild Reaction releases a communique.
Uh-huh.
All right. That is a result of, like, trust, right, with certain technologies. Like, you release the communique because you don't want to start getting into individual accountability. Well, we have technology now where everyone can do the individual commentary.
Mm.
And not only that, they don't have to actually... represent a recognizable identity.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. Are you talking about someone who can just like throw a blog up that has nothing to do with their actual person? No
right.
one knows who they are, and they're just a thing.
Right.
Or you know, you can be popular on YouTube or all these things.
Yeah, and then at the same time, there is a lack of collective organizations that do release statements. Even, I mean, obviously, you're going to release a communique if you're an illegalist.
Sure. Well, sometimes.
But if you're just, like, the local anarchists, you don't really do that. You just have the fucking, group chat or message board or whatever. And you say, I'm an anarchist from here. I'm an anarchist from here. And everybody, like, comes together with their own individual voice, which is preferable in a way. But it does change the effort, I guess, that goes into actually coming to a position.
Well, I guess, I mean, on some level, even though I have issue with that, you know, classical style meeting in a giant auditorium, giving a speech anarchy of, of like having like Johan Moist up there and he's arguing and people will yell in the crowd and support or not support. And it's a whole thing. And he's commenting on public events and he's talking about how, you know, talking shit on Alexander Berkman and then someone's getting involved and then all that. And we don't really have that much. I mean, once in a while that kind of stuff happens, but like for the most part, it seems like what we, you know, me and you go to anarchist study group. I know there's a couple other anarchist study groups in the Bay, but for the amount of like quote radical people here, there's not really that many places these conversations are happening. And I mean, you go to the same things I go to. Like if we go to a large presentation, it's not usually a very lively conversation. And I think it's hard to say, but a lot of it just boils down to the fact that we don't know how to communicate as human beings on a fundamental level, and anarchists are just as guilty of this as anyone. And it's so difficult to have a good faith conversation with someone you know, and exponentially more difficult with someone you don't know, that I feel like a lot of it's just you can't really get into a real conversation at these presentations. Plus the fact that once someone's on stage, we have this whole, you know, lionization and putting them up on a pedestal that, you know, people value their words more than the words of some random person in the audience, which is totally antithetical to the anarchist project, but nonetheless happens to an extreme degree.
Yeah, well, I keep coming back to like, yeah, I totally agree with you that there is this absolute like degeneration of honest conversation that actually is meant to remain in relationship with the other participants. You know, everything's like a drive-by shooting.
Yeah.
And nothing's connected. There's no like follow-up. And there's just a level of depth that you can never reach because of that. But the fact that when we critique something, there's actually no real like force that we're critiquing, you know, internally within anarchism. Like you could critique anarchist news, uh-huh. or you could critique like it's going down, or like, you know, whatever fucking coffee shop. But you don't have a lot of power to critique. And this is a weird thing, right? Because it doesn't mean that people aren't doing anything, but it does mean that what people are doing, you can't talk about it. Because you have to just, if they don't represent themselves collectively,
yeah,
then you could only talk about them individually. So, and critique like the kernel of the idea that they're working with.
So flesh out more what you mean by force.
Well, okay, so when you have like something like a huge labor union like the IWW, and they come to a solid agreement about what they're going to do,
okay,
given whatever circumstance, like president gets shot or something like that, you could critique their response and you could kind of like have this kind of deep dialogue about it. Whereas now, there's nothing really like that. It's all individuated. And when it's not, what it represents is like very tiny, tiny groups of people that actually can't do much.
Yeah. So before the show started, we were trying to figure out what the benefits of anarchist discourse were. And, you know, we might just be pessimists in general, or it might just be easier to critique than it is to, you know, laud the good efforts of things. But the benefits that we came up with, Squee, were so the benefits of anarchist discourse as it is right now were the sharing and spread of tactics, the fact that projects can arise from this discourse. My problem would be the discourse sucks, so sometimes shitty projects tend to arise more than interesting projects.
Right.
Maybe my argument would be that there's not even enough space for an interesting project to arise because creativity is not what is valued right now. And before I get to that, go ahead.
I totally don't agree with that. Let's go on.
Well, then we should talk about it. But, and then the last thing, which is what you said, was that sometimes, occasionally, mutual aid can arise from the current discourse.
Right.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Well, you might find a place to live.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. It's once again, a narcissistic thing. You found a place to live. I guess I found a place to live, too.
I think a lot of anarchists have found their living arrangements through conversation with other anarchists.
This is a fair point.
Right. I mean, I definitely for years have only lived with anarchists.
I can't say the same. I've tried to live with anarchists and found out I was not living with anarchists, well, much to my dismay.
Yeah, that's something else.
Yeah, that's a whole nother thing. So you disagree that creativity is not valued?
Well, valued by who, right?
Valued by the current anarchist discourse as it is.
So that's something that we should talk about is why does it matter what the anarchist discourse values?
Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing we're saying. Does it matter? So do you think it even matters what the overarching conversation as it exists now in the real looks like in anarchy world or anarchism, anarchy in general? Does it matter what people are talking about? Does it matter how people are talking?
And this is a very like bloody line to cross, I think, is to answer this question. And I kind of think, no, it doesn't. It almost does not fucking matter.
Because?
Because I think that anarchists are in such a minority now, especially post-Occupy, with nothing to interact with, that the internal discourse is irrelevant. And except for, like, report backs. I mean, you know, this is the way that creativity gets devalued, is because we're not outward-facing a lot of the time in our discourse. We're inward-looking. You know, and me and you are guilty of that as much as anyone else. But no, I don't think it matters. I think what's relevant is when you actually have a conflict with non-anarchists.
Okay, so you're saying anarchists pushing their force out into non-anarchist world is where anarchist relevance is relevant. And how many times can I say relevant in one sentence right there?
I totally do. I mean, I think that...
So then do you think it's not relevant? So let's throw the opposite example. So, like, say there's a bunch of people, like, anarchists on an island somewhere, maybe, and they are doing a land project outside the world of anarchy. Is that relevant then? Or I guess it's relevant to them, obviously, but do you think it's relevant to anarchist projects that is happening?
Like, is their conversation internally relevant?
Well, like, is that action part of the discourse for you?
Yeah, it is, but not because of the conversation that they're having.
It's, well... But are they, I guess you can see dropping out as a conflict with the Force, leaving it with the non-anarchist Force, I guess. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay. Well, I mean, say we're in a conflict. One way for me to have conflict with you, which is also a way to end the conflict, is to, like, move out and never speak or deal with you again, which is more or less the idea of a land project, right? To drop out of society, you know, like, to be part of a dropout culture.
Yeah. But I also, I mean, I think there's another interpretation of what that is. And to me, like, that could be getting off the grid and building a force that could...
So it's ultimately it's a you're saying that project is more of a tactic to strengthen and come back and fight for ground or whatever.
I think it could be. I mean, it depends how you look at it. I don't know, but I think our internal discourse, I mean, for as gummy as it is with the comments and the all the bullshit, the projects that come out of it are okay. I think that does happen. I think it happens in spite of discouragement. And this is an interesting thing, right? I don't think it's very encouraging to see how harshly other anarchists get criticized for their projects. If you want to start a new one. However, I think to do something regardless makes your project better.
Well, I mean, I can tell you when me and Bellamy first started, we recorded, we were living in the same 13-person house with a bunch of assholes. And one of the people that we were actually friends with, we brought her and we showed her the first show that we ever did. And she listened to the show and we're like, man, we put a lot of time into this. We like made up a name for the show. We wrote a bio. We like did this whole thing. This is our idea. Here's our first show. And she was more or less like, you should probably stop doing this. This is really bad. No one's going to listen to this. It's terrible. Please don't do this anymore. We kept going. So,
yeah, and I think that's what, you know, the whole pressure forges diamonds kind of fucking thing.
Yeah, and I think that's part of, like, whatever I like to consider the anarchist spirit is that, like, you have a passion and desire, and you're going to fucking do that thing no matter what people have to say about it. Like,
right. So, know? But at the same time, that same attitude is also, like, problematic for having a conversation with other anarchists.
Totally.
Like, the attitude you have to adopt to do that makes you a totally unagreeable person with other anarchists.
This is true.
So, I mean, it's... Yeah, you're a diamond, but you're a diamond that ain't, you're not gonna be anywhere near any other diamond. You gotta like stand out and shine your fucking shine.
This is like turning into a dandy conversation now.
Well, I think this is sort of like, I think that is sort of the production of anarchist projects today is this kind of problem, right? So you have all this pressure to do the amazing thing. To actually represent the embodiment of anarchy or whatever the fuck you want to call it.
Right.
And then you wind up not being able to talk to anybody else because of it.
Well, I think that's one of the biggest problems with anarchist discourse as a whole, which is, you know, I'm going to keep going with what I was saying earlier, which I think most anarchists are socialists, mass movementists. They want to redistribute things. They want a better government that they don't see as government, kind of something like you witness in the book The Dispossessed, which we thought about talking about today but didn't,
right.
Where you more or less have a central committee. I'm not saying central committee with a negative connotation. I'm saying in the best way, a place where people can choose their work, find places to live, find food. Your basic necessities are covered by some type of world government, whatever. Obviously, I hate this. but I'm trying to frame in a positive light in this way. But I'm saying even with this done, like, I don't know. I just think that creates a problem because then you're looking for, like we were talking about earlier, universal application. So I think a lot of times anarchists are trying to solve problems outside of their scope, right? Like, and in it's just really fucking hard. Even world governments with all their power can't really solve these problems. You know, they still come across issues with this stuff. Welcome back to Free Radical Radio. This episode is episode 91. It has been brought to you by, what are they called? Camel Crush, where we believe in consumer choice because we believe if you want to smoke a cigarette, you should be able to smoke a menthol or a regular cigarette, and you should be able to cut that percentage into whatever you want. I happen to smoke 100% regular. Squee, what percentage menthol do you prefer?
Yeah, it depends on my mood. You know, the one thing I know is once you put it into menthol, you can't put it back.
Yeah, that's my biggest complaint about Camel Crushes because I hate menthol cigarettes, and I'll crush it once in a while, and I'm like, oh, fuck, I wish I didn't do that. I always regret it. I always regret the crush.
Yeah, you know.
I can say that for my life. Every time I've had a crush, I've regretted it later. Whether it be in 1 month or 5 years, I regret it. I strongly regret it.
You got to know when to put it out.
Yeah, that's...
And light another. That's the solution, right?
Yeah, all right. So what else do you think about, like, anarchist discourse could change? Do you think there's a different way it could look? Do you think a website like Anarchist News could look different? Obviously, It's Going Down made something different.
But I don't know how much it affected the discourse.
I would say not, personally. I don't know. Mostly just because I think they're just posting leftist news, a mix of leftist and then anarchist news.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not even really the content. It's like, you know, the way that you create a conversation is by having a conversation. And if you don't invite that, then you're just putting an object out there to be kind of admired or hated on someone's own personal time.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to think about what the motivation behind that was exactly. It seemed like the motivation, honestly, was to have a different version of Anarchist News, to have like an Anarchist News website. But I think the problem was they chased a mainstream idea instead of coming up with a creative, different idea.
Well, they definitely, I mean, from looking at the responses on Anarchist News to the development of that website, it looked like the comments were their main problem with the format of Anarchist News.
Yeah.
And how it kind of creates a quote-unquote cesspool.
Sure.
That was the difference they tried to affect. And that, unfortunately, when you do that, it almost makes you a commodity. I mean, you turn yourself into an object.
Yeah, totally. instead of changing the conversation, they just ended the conversation.
Right.
Which is unfortunate. Because even I would be somewhat interested in that conversation, even if it was just so much as to see, like, okay, what are insurrectionary anarchists thinking in general? And you don't really get that on the site, to be honest, you know?
Yeah, you know, I could understand that they'd be worried about getting, like, totally bombed by whoever they think their opponents are.
Couldn't they just negate that with having to log in under a certain username, though, and not having anonymous comments?
Yeah.
I would be interested to see if they tried that to see what that looked like.
It would be pretty. Yeah, I don't know. I think that would be a good move. I mean,
I guess this is the essence of OPP. We try to help other people's projects.
Other people's projects.
When we should probably be helping our project the most.
No, not ours. Nah. Is it infallible?
I once wrote in a poem. It's easy to take care of other people's problems because then you don't have to think about your own, which kind of boils down to the essence of charity and altruism, problems in that direction, you know? They're ultimately selfish, negating acts of your own self.
Yeah.
That's what I believe. Oscar Wilde agrees with me. We just read Soul of Man under Socialism at study group. I read it and Squeeze showed up for the conversation and interjected pointless comments from not having read it.
I thought my comments were pretty pointed.
Okay, so now we're going to get to, should we call it Wingnut Confessional?
No.
Let's,
I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. It's called something. We're going to talk about population and, you know, maybe one of us has more of a Malthusian bent than the other one.
Right, yeah. Well, this actually comes out of the study group is we kind of, after reading the Oscar Wilde piece or not reading it.
Yeah.
Some of the little quacking birds decided to talk about population size and how it relates to a socialist world of machines.
Yeah, we should talk about it because in Soul of Man Under Socialism, Oscar Wilde starts out with a really excellent we'll link to it. There's a really good audiobook version. I love the audiobook of this. Some guy did a totally wacky, weird version that I think is super engaging. It actually made me rethink the way I want to record audiobooks in general, but I'll post a link to the episode. So if you're listening now, you can just look down through the bottom and there'll be a link for it. But anyways, so Oscar Wilde starts off by kind of criticizing charity, criticizing, how would you call it? Not just charity, but, like in general, trying to help pull people up. Like,
well, all right. So I read enough of it to know that his primary concern is basically the character of an individual.
Right.
And what he is emphasizing is the way that different conditions affect the character and whether or not, like, poverty is good for somebody's character or, you know, charity is good for their character and just how you develop into an individual sort of Renaissance man.
Yeah, like what's the best way to foster individual creativity and the project the individual chooses for themselves, which Oscar Wilde puts under the medium of art, which I think can largely be seen as an abstraction, but I think what he's really getting at is just self-expression, more or less.
Right. He's basically setting up a scenario where all your primary needs are taken care of, and yeah. then you could actually make a conscious decision about what you want to see in the world instead of being driven by compulsion to eat or compulsion to whatever else.
Which is interesting.
To shelter or whatever.
Which is interesting because as the essay goes on, he kind of wing nuts out super hard, in my opinion, and ends up saying that the way this is going to happen for human beings, the only way it's going to happen is a society where machines do all the undesirable jobs. Basically, all manual labor, anything that's not creative, will be done, like, ipso facto, completely by machines.
Right, which is a very old idea. I mean, Aristotle talks about that. The way that he talks about it is that some form of artwork will be able to produce other artwork, but it's an old idea that the socialist mind has been waiting on for quite some time.
It's an interesting idea because it starts off with a huge problem, which is who creates the machines in the first place.
Right, yeah. We've been waiting for that genius to just infect the right person.
And I think the ultimate answer to that, right, is the machines create the other machines. Like, you start off with the machines creating the machines, but then your whole setup of society is being done by non-human, non-organic entities, and that is quite a way to develop a society.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you're completely trusting the machines to do the entire work of, keeping people alive, more or less.
But the real problem isn't actually survival to begin with. It's that, you know, people develop standards and then, you know, standard of living is what they call it, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that keeps going up.
Right.
And, you know.
Well, more.
Different. It gets different.
Yeah.
Standard of living gets different. And then, mm-hmm. you know, we have some whole other fucking hodgepodge way of creating that standard of living.
Okay. So right now the population is estimated to be somewhere between 7.3 and around like 8.3 billion people. And this is according to 15 seconds of Wikipedia that I looked at with Squeeze sitting behind me. So take that for what it is.
Breathing down your neck.
Yeah. Either way, there's quite a lot of humans on the planet, any way you shake it. I guess there's more ants. You know, they say the total mass of ants is bigger than that of humans. So, but in our anthropocentric view, we tend to see humans as the most prevalent species on the planet.
Yeah.
Hard to disagree. We have a pretty big effect.
Right.
And this is funny because this is actually one of the things I complained about in To Our Friends, where the Invisible Committee piece, where they were saying that we, like, you know, people think they have this huge effect on the planet. And their critique of the Anthropocene was, and the Anthropocene is the idea that humans have created a new like era on the planet through our invention or intervention into the way the planet is with extraction and building and all the things we do, travel through ships, planes, cars, bikes, what have you. And they were saying that it's anthropocentric view. And my personal take is it's just a pragmatic, realistic view. I think that's an honest way to look at the situation. And I think we have changed things.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, how many options do you have besides the anthropocentric one? Right. Like, what are you actually going to fucking accomplish by not being anthropocentric? So let's take the ants, for example. Are you going to embody or invoke the ant spirit?
If you're Peter Kropotkin, you are for sure.
And intervene in ant life and create the situation that will best suit the ants. If you're a human being, you're making human decisions. You're right. Not making ecocentric or ant-centric decisions.
And I think the whole crux of it is, like, the crux of a greed anarchist position, at least, would be, like, in making a human-centric decision, you are making decisions that benefit the other things around you because that's what's best for you is when the other creatures around you are benefiting because you need food to eat, place to sleep, air to breathe. So those types of decisions, your selfish decisions, can't actually benefit you and the things around you.
For a green anarchist, kind of. But if you take it to the extreme of green anarchism, it's that you could actually somehow communicate with other beings, right?
I believe that.
Well, you might. I don't.
Okay.
I do not think that I'm informed in my actions by the existence of other things.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree strongly with that. I think I'm informed by the tides. I think I think it's hard not, I mean, it's hard not to say that the water in my body, I'm made up of what, 75% water or something like that. When the tides shift and the moon changes, my body is literally changing. I am completely informed by these things. Like, the, you know, different times of the day, the sun affects me. We don't even know the way suns and darkness and how much time we spend inside and outside truly affects us. Like, even if you're looking at our sleep cycles and things like that, I think the world around us definitely affects us. And I think the amount of predators around us affects us. And I don't think it's so much as, like, do I go to a tree and, like, find the soul of the tree and find some type of thing there? Like, sure, maybe. Maybe you do. I personally don't. Maybe other people do. That's fine with me. But I think we're definitely affected to an extreme degree by non-human forces.
But it's not about whether or not you're affected. It's about whether or not you could actually act in the name of or act in...
Oh, sure. No, I don't think so that either.
Right. So that's the problem.
That is the main problem, right, with, like, leftist anarchy and with green anarchy with a leftist bent. And I'm using leftist because in the way that... When I'm saying leftist here, what I mean is human interventionist and speaking on behalf of those who are not spoken. So if you're like when you see an animal rights movement saying we speak for the animals because they can't speak for themselves. No, fuck you. They can speak for themselves. You just aren't fucking listening. You know, like when an orca gets taken away and it's like making the whale noises and it's really unhappy that this kid's been taken away. It's speaking for itself. We're just not listening.
Yeah, but what I see, the thing is, what makes that not anthropocentric? Anyway, like, if you're affected as a sort of, you know, you're this kind of entity in the universe that is affected by other beings, it's, you still have a viewpoint or a perspective that is centralized around your experience. Like, the whole fucking thing is nonsense. Like, to speak with a voice that represents your experience, that is it. That's the only thing you could do.
Yeah, well, like, you're talking about extreme subjectivity at this point.
Well, but what I'm not saying is that I have any ability to be a representative of, anything else.
That's why I was using the word leftist, because when I use that word as a critique, I'm mainly talking about what I was saying before, which is just representation, and you're giving a voice to something that's not you, which is what both of us, if we were to have, which we're not going to, if we were to talk about why we don't like democracy or federalization, it's because... someone's representing you at some point.
Yeah, but the thing is that criticism comes up a lot, right? Is that somebody, you know, I'll present on something to do with human psychology, and someone will say, "Oh, that's an anthropocentric perspective," and it's like,
of course.
My comeback is always like, no, it's an egocentric.
Sure.
Because I'm not representing humanity either.
Okay, I see what you're saying there. And we'll develop this further in this. So what you're trying to say is that it's not human-centric, it's squeeze-centric.
Sure, yeah. I mean, if you're not speaking by your own positionality in the order of things, or whatever you want to call it, then you are making some kind of a claim about other entities.
And this is why I'm not interested in any project which seeks to represent me or something else, or does not recognize me as me, disregarding humanity around me. Like, I don't want to be part of the global humanity. I want to be, you know, if I had to, it's more of a union of egos type thing.
Right, and this is exactly, like, the thing about humanism in the left and the population question that we're going to eventually get into.
Yeah, so let's get into it right now. So human population is a problem for many people. It's a problem for me because I fucking hate crowds of people. It's a problem for me because when I go out into the ocean and I want to surf the best waves, there are tons of people there and it's very competitive. These are the main problems I have as far as population goes. You also have problems of feeding people. You have problems of borders and exclusion and the world being divided up because there's so many people. You know, blah, blah, blah. We could go on endlessly about all the problems. Squee, what do you think the main problem is for people who are trying to tackle population as an issue? Like, where do you see the most fault in the thinking of people as they attack this?
All right. So I have a huge issue with this line of thinking where somehow you imagine a world with less people. To me, that's already immediately admitting that you have failed. So as a thinking individual, you have failed to find a way to answer and resolve the problems in your life.
I think you left out the first part. You're saying you're talking about anyone who uses the premise of their anarchy being existing in a world with you know, half the many people we have, or like just 100 billion people in general, right? You're
right,
talking about people who say, oh, world population can't exist like that. Let's think of an anarchy with less people.
But it doesn't have to be anarchists either. I mean, this is a big thing with the, you know, Malthusians are often right-wing, right?
Yeah, we're referencing, you know, Thomas,
like,
Malthus.
Like the Browning of America. You know, there's too many people populating, and they're from the Brown countries or whatever the fuck you want to...
Yeah.
So the whole problem for me is, like, fundamentally what you're doing, immediately, you're starting off on a foot that is rejecting reality. Reality is there are 7.3 to 8.5 billion people on Earth.
Right.
And if immediately you are saying, okay, the problem is reality, you're not coming up with a solution. You're coming up with, like, this fantasy about what could be in ideal circumstances. But the whole thing about really thinking about how to live is that you don't have ideal circumstances. I mean, if it was that easy, then we might as well be transhumanists and, like, start our day off with a menu in front of our face that says, what would you like to experience today? And just fucking click the button and have that experience and go day to day like that.
Yeah.
And
like Star Trek.
But that's not life. I mean, life is dealing with life. And anarchism for me is... What has always been intriguing to me about it is it looks at reality, how it actually is unfolding, and says, look at what the workers are doing. They are going on strike. They're revolting. Look at what prostitutes are doing. Look at what all these other people are doing who reject authority. That's what we're for. You know, instead of, like, this whole fucking world of imaginary scenarios,
right?
It looks at the existent. And finds the people that do exist that find ways to revolt, and bases itself off of that. That's what I love about it. Like, to me, that's real. That's, like, gets my blood going.
Yeah, and it relates to a little bit about the Batman thing we were talking about the other day. We were talking about planners and schemers, and you know, people are comfortable when it goes according to plan, right? So the problem is most of the anarchist plans people create are fantasies. They're, like you're saying, they're based in the belief that all of a sudden 7 billion people will die. Like you were saying earlier, a cataclysm, right?
Right.
Like they're based in eschatological thinking, like religious thinking, where, you know, there's going to be a significant event such as, you know, the fall from grace, the fall from Eden we had when we started society. And again, there will be a fall from society. And we will go back to this other time, or that we'll be presented with an opportunity to use these plans and schemes we've been creating. But this is all resting on a very questionable premise.
Exactly, right. Like, if the ideal conditions have to happen before your fucking philosophy matters, why would I listen to you? If you could actually prove to me that somehow everything's going to fall into place perfectly so that you could live out your little anarchist utopia... Yeah, I'll listen to you, but no one does that.
Well, I mean, I can relate this to individual relationships. I've been in relationships with people where the foundation and the premise were wrong, where we were not capable of good communication. They hadn't worked out issues from their past. Maybe I hadn't either. We were both maybe playing out some traumas we'd had earlier in our life or something. And I would think to myself in the relationship, like, you know, once a few years go by and we're both the people that we want to be, then everything will be fine. And I think that's kind of the same line of thinking. And this also relates a little bit to Sharon, who would say people have two things going on. They have the self, which is the actual life they lead, the day-to-day things they do, whether that means they stay in bed all day because they're depressed and that's their baseline, or, you know, they do a little bit of their project once in a while. And then the self, right, is like Novatori. They're a carnival of joy, and they see them, whatever they see the self as. Like, maybe that's how I would see my self, right? As this person who wakes up, fights things all day, withdraws all the time, has endless energy for friends and projects and all this. But that's an ideation. That's not the real of what's going on with you.
Well, that's an important point. I mean, I used to watch a lot of TED Talks.
Uh-huh.
And one of the ones that has stuck with me is this dude came on there and was like, it was about happiness and, like, actually trying to figure out how to quantify happiness and actually deal with the question. And he goes on to say, you know, people really think of themselves in two ways. They have a narrative version of themselves, and they have a version of themselves that is every day. You know, what the pain that they're feeling, the anxiety they're feeling, the pleasure they're feeling. And depending on the way that you phrase the question, you're going to talk to a different way that somebody thinks about their situation. So if you ask somebody like, how happy do you feel? You're going to immediately talk to that experiential version of their idea of themselves. But if you ask somebody, how happy are you? You're going to tap into this narration of somebody's life. And I think what happens is that, you know, with anarchism, it's very tempting to get into a narrative about what we want life to be,
mm-hmm.
instead of at the expense of dealing with your day-to-day life. And this is like a form of compensation, I think, that's, to me, unfortunate.
Well, I mean, it's one of the biggest problems of anarchy in general is if you want to be an anarchist right now, the simple fact is you are living in a world that is nearly 100% antithetical to everything you want and believe in, right? Like to so it's almost like you're an elephant living the life of a wild turkey, or, you know, you're an octopus living the life of a bald eagle. And how do you live an octopus life if you're in a society of bald eagles and you yourself look in the mirror and see a bald eagle?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the whole – I mean, and then it comes back to humanism, right?
Yeah. And then so how do you get from here to there if there isn't even a place, really?
Well, but why does – I mean
– And do you want to get there? And that's the other question, I guess, when we get into prefigurative politics is why I think people like me and you tend to shy away from a there, because we want to go from here and move someplace else. And it's not there. There is no there. You have to make there as you travel from here. And you can't just know where it is. Like, I mean, and that's the main problem. Like, I guess some people can think, you know, maybe go join some, you know, tribe that's uncontacted in some part of the Amazon or something, if they'll have you. Best case scenario for getting from here to there, right? And then maybe you get to that tribe and it's got some weird rituals that you don't consider very anarchistic. What do you do at that point?
But it's totally fucking unnecessary to do that, because you could start here and start doing the things you want and keep doing that. There's no need to have it there.
Yeah, so I think the key is not compromising, right? It's or compromising as little as possible.
Yes, resistance and revolt.
Right.
I mean, that these big words that anarchists like to use, you know, happen to be, you know, applicable on a everyday personal scale.
Right, and maybe it looks different than street fighting the police with a bunch of liberal nonprofit groups, right? Like, maybe there's a different, maybe that's what it looks like sometimes, but maybe it looks something else. Maybe we don't really even know what that looks like because we're not trying to create that. We're trying to follow plans, or we're so depressed because the there is so far from the here that it seems impossible to get there, because it is, that it is almost paralyzing to get started, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I know quite a number of people that do function in that way.
Right.
And this is my whole project is to try to bring that to light and like help other people see that, yeah, you can be a resisting person and something happens from it.
So and Squee's like, whole project is to help people, in case you didn't know.
Well, that's true. I'm not gonna lie. I'm not doing this to help myself. I don't get anything out of this.
That is a load of horseshit. Right,
I know.
There.
It's the best. It's the biggest drop of horseshit.
That was the biggest poop you ever dropped in the show. But yeah, I mean, that's a tough question, right? Like, and that almost relates back to the discourse, because I do find a lack of creativity in projects, and I find a lack of spreading of things. Like, I think simple things spread. Like, what's the thing that spread the most? Occupy, right? That's the thing in our lives that spread the most.
I want to say something about that real quick.
Go ahead.
I think anarchists keep underestimating the intervention of Adbusters into Occupy, which is a national fucking glossy ass fucking magazine that's been in mainstream stores for a decade.
I didn't even know people read that. I didn't even know what Adbusters was until Occupy.
Right. Which is like almost a post-situationist idea. I mean, this whole Occupy thing does come... Anyway, whatever.
No, keep going. I'm interested.
Well, so, I mean, the whole idea of it is a very post-situationist idea. And, I mean, just the way...
What do you mean when you say post-situationist?
Well, Adbusters practices detournement, right? That's, like, their main... The motif of the magazine is detorned images.
What? How would you explain detornment?
It's basically taking a mainstream image and changing the meaning of it to suit a narrative you're trying to promote.
So you're trying to change the narrative to a narrative that suits you better.
Right.
Okay.
And, I mean, that's probably a bad definition, but whatever. So Occupy didn't come out of nowhere. In fact, it came out of, a very well-established group of people that had plenty of contacts and could, spend, I think it was, 6 months or something, the first time I heard about there was going to be an Occupy Wall Street. It took a while to even get that together, and who knew it would blow up to what it blew up to, but it didn't come out of nowhere, and it definitely did not come from, the rage of the populace bubbling up and overthrowing the...
Yeah, I don't think so either.
So, yeah, I mean, the whole example to begin with is already weird.
I mean, that was a huge deal. I don't think we talk about it enough as anarchists. I think some anarchists want to negate it completely, and I've tended to be on that side before, and I think that's a mistake. And I think...
Well, and then you get David Graeber if you want to negate it completely and be like, oh, it was anarchists.
Which is a lie. Right. Anyone that went to an Occupy or participated knows anarchists were the minority, even in Occupy Oakland, which had the most anarchist bent of maybe any of them in America, at least. And, it was not a majority of anarchists, despite living in, one of the cities where there's are the most anarchists besides, maybe New York or something like that.
Right. Yeah. But, it comes out of a rather old project of, shit like Adbusters and people who want to walk the fence between mainstream political discourse and radical.
And occupying has been a tactic that's been used for a long time. But it's never been used so exclusively and so strongly, I would say.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, immediately preceding it were the student occupations all over California.
Right, right, right. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. But... So I don't know. Maybe that's something we should talk about more and pay more attention to and think maybe – I know people have written books about it. They mostly seemed uninteresting when I pieced through them. But, what exactly went on there and what are – if the idea of an anarchist – which many of it is, right, is even like Little Black Cart, which is, clearly they're post-leftists or whatever. They're largely, I would say, most of them are obviously anti-civ people involved in that project, all that stuff. They're still trying to spread anarchy, right? Obviously, if you're publishing books, you're trying to spread the idea of anarchy and change the conversation of anarchy. So even a project like that is interested in spreading anarchy. And obviously, we are too. It'd be a lie if we said we weren't. Obviously, we could sit here and say, we're doing this project just for ourselves, 100% egocentric. But the fact of the matter is we do engage a little bit when people email us and we read what people say and all that. So obviously, part of this is to spread ideas and change the discourse, right? So on that level, Occupy should be interesting to us because it affected the anarchist discourse for sure.
Well, it's totally interesting. It's just that... Can we please admit to the other factors that went into it,
and right?
Not,
can we
and not delude ourselves and be create our own narrative, which is like this weird insurrectionary anarchist tendencies to rewrite history or whatever,
right? And pretend it made a bunch of anarchists, or pretend everyone...
Well, it did. It did get a lot.
Sure,
but because anarchists everywhere intervened.
Yeah. I personally would say that's more from conversations people were having than from people being out in the street and being like, oh, no, this thing happened. I don't know. I think it's more of a general a talking thing than.
It's more than that. I mean, what Occupy did is it gave everybody a real life example of why anarchy can be relevant. I mean, instead of talking about drum circles and punk shows and Linux and the random thing in Greece or, Exarchia, it gave people in every fucking state there was an Occupy a reference point to something different outside of capital.
Plus, I think the most important part was that everyday people living in cities with an Occupy had to deal with it on some level. They either had to see all the TV reports about it, they had to see it in the news, they had to run into traffic problems because of some Occupy thing happening. Right now, people living their life almost have no possible way or necessity to engage with anarchists at all. Like, you could go through your whole life right now for weeks, years, without coming across an anarchist or knowing an anarchist, without having some protest or demo affect your life in any way. When Occupy was happening, that did not happen. Every normal person in my life was talking to me about it. Like, my aunt, my uncle were like, fuck, I couldn't get to work today. The traffic was so bad. Like, what are the – even? And most of it was negative, right? Like, these fucking anarchists suck. But I think some people are like, what's going on here?
Yeah, and look how hard it got crushed.
So hard.
So, all right. So this goes back to exactly what I was saying, is this is interface, is the way of having conflict instead of between anarchists. Like, I mean, how fucking important is it that people respect, like, the coherence of our fucking arguments? I mean, what people really respect is right. A real alternative. I mean, you know, dude, like, if somebody shows me, like, a way that I could live the way I want, I don't care what their fucking philosophy is about it. I look at the mechanics of it and I'm like, oh, yeah, that works.
And I think that's most things we're passionate about, whether it's a way of life or something. It's like when you experience it, right? Like, at least for me, I'm in, like, the best relationship I've ever been in. And I can talk about a jibber-jabber for years, but, like, now that I experience it, I don't want to get in those other fucking shitty ones. Like, you know, I'm polyamorous, obviously. So, like, when I go on other dates with other people, when I start seeing someone else that's not as – that doesn't communicate as well or have the same level of respect or give the same amount of space that I have in my current relationship or allow for the same type of autonomy that I'm allowed and that I allow the other main person I see, like – I recognize it because it's something real that I'm living. When I've been thinking about this since, you know, I've been dating, what, since I was like 17. It's been like 13, 14 years of dating at this point. And I would think about these things all the time, but because I wasn't living them, it didn't change the way I did it. I had to live something different. I had to encounter a different reality for myself to change the way I was able to avoid the other situations and all that. So I think encountering anarchist ways of life is a good way to be like, oh, fuck, I really don't want to do these other things. And you realize what a shitty way the things were happening before are, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, we could go on forever about this. I mean, once we start talking about the way anarchists live now that we yeah. know, and then, like, questioning whether or not that is appealing or convincing the, the fucking whoever else. Yeah. I mean, there's appealing things about being an anarchist once you start interfacing with liberals or interfacing with all these other fucking idiots.
Right.
But
but I mean, that is something I want to talk about at a later date, Squeeze, that I do think one interesting thing that's happened, and I don't know if I'm not going to say anarchists did this, but I'm going to say I think it's an inherently type of anarchist behavior, which is like a relationship anarchy or a level of polyamory, which really relates to treating people as objects and commodities and private property and making a real attempt not to do that by not telling someone what else to do with their body. I think that is a super anarchistic idea. And I think that's a way you can live anarchistically in this world, is to like be dating someone you care about and say, actually, if you want to touch someone else, I'm not someone to tell you not to. That's insane. That's proprietarian. That's fucking, you know, hierarchical. Like, I'm trying to avoid all these things. And I think that's interesting.
I think it's interesting. I feel that way too. We'll have to talk about it another time.
Yeah, we'll talk about this another time, but okay, so we gave you a little preview of a coming attraction. Is there anything else you have to say today?
Well, the population thing, we never, like, concluded it.
Okay, let's keep talking. All right, so is it possible to be an anarchist in a non-anarchist society then?
All right, so I think yes. Maybe we did talk about it, I mean, yeah,
I think we're done.
All right, we're done? Yeah. All right, bye!
This is Free Radical Radio. You can find us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net. You can email us at... You can email us at freeradicalradio@riseup.net. You can find us at freeradicalradio.net. You can find all of our audiobooks at freeradicalradio.net. If you look under the tab of presentations and audiobooks, we have a lot of good ones there. I highly suggest it. If you want a t-shirt, you can email us and I will go into the t-shirt mines and send you a t-shirt and some stickers and some zines. We've got a bunch of really fucking good ones. This is Free Radical Radio, episode 91. Goodbye.
Bye.